From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a girl lied awake in bed one night, dreaming of a best friend. She was thinking about a girl that she knew, a girl named Laura, a fictional character who seemed so real in the book series known as Little House or Little House on the Prairie. The girl lying in bed, Linda Sue, imagined that she and Laura were inseparable, and she had grand visions of new adventures on the prairie. But here's where Linda Sue's dreams diverge from the dreams of most kids. Most kids who are 8, 10 years old, reading a fiction series, are not all that concerned about historical accuracy. But for Linda Sue, something was a little off. She knew she really couldn't envision herself in that scene realistically in the 1800s because Linda Sue's Korean. There were very few Koreans on the prairie at the time. And there was something else. Linda Sue knew that if she could somehow travel in time and hang out with a real-life Laura, Laura's ma would not allow it. Linda Sue's black hair and tan Korean skin would be considered too different, too close to the Indian people, who ma did not view as equals in the books. And so that 8-year-old girl lying in bed did something most kids don't think about doing. She loved those Little House books, and she reread them, but when she did, she would then take clumps of the pages and skip over them. Something in young Linda Sue told her that racism was not okay, even if the stories were grand. Well, today, Linda Sue Park is an award-winning author, a prolific author, and her newest book is personal, and it is decades in the making. It's called Prairie Lotus, and in an author's note, Linda Sue describes it as an attempt at a painful reconciliation between her childhood love for Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House series and her adult knowledge of racism. During this time of pandemic, this conversation is timely. Some Asian Americans are feeling stereotyped or judged or blamed. We're honored to have author Linda Sue Park back with us on the line on Connections. Linda Sue Park, how are you?
I'm fine, and thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Well, I'm looking forward to this conversation. And before we do that, I just want to briefly once again welcome in WXXI News health reporter Brett Dahlberg, who's with us in studio. Just kind of popping in here, talking about a couple of things. First of all, what we're looking at in terms of updates, in terms of COVID cases, sort of the incremental march continues. We're not seeing, a dramatic spike, but every day there's more.
Every day there's more. We had only 4 new ones overnight, which, you know, we say only. And part, again, of the reason for the only is that we don't have a high testing capacity here. And we just learned yesterday that the county health department is prioritizing certain cases for who gets tested. That is, if you are symptomatic, they're going to ask you basically just to stay home unless you are a symptomatic healthcare worker. If you're a person in a hospital or a nursing home whose symptoms have evolved, or if the county is pursuing contact tracing because you've been near a lot of other people and then developed symptoms. So in general, we know that the number of cases that we're seeing is probably far lower than the number of cases that are present in the community. There is another change today, which comes on the state level. Just maybe an hour ago or so, Governor Cuomo said that he's going to sign an executive order requiring that businesses, non-essential businesses, have 100% of their staff work from home. And so that number has kind of been incrementally increasing through the week. It started at about 50%, then it went up to 75%, stayed at 75% for, I think, 24, maybe 48 hours. And now here we are at the end of the week with the governor saying that 100% of the staff at non-essential employers should be working from home.
Okay, so that's Governor Cuomo. And Cuomo, by the way, from everything I've seen, and you've seen more than I have on that particular order, Brett, he essentially said, look, if you don't like this, don't blame your local government. Don't blame your elected leaders. This is my call and I will own it.
He definitely took responsibility for it. He said, this is my decision. It is my executive order. But what he said also was that this is the one side of the equation that he has control over. The governor said, we're coming up short on the number of ventilators that we're going to need, absent some drastic social distancing measures. We're coming up short on the number of ICU units that he predicts that we'll need, again, absent some of these pretty extreme social distancing measures. And so he said the one side of the equation that he does have some control over, because he can't just build new ICUs, he can't just manufacture out of thin air new ventilator units. So he said the one side of the equation that he does have some control over is where people go and how many of them go out. And he said that's the side that he's trying to make a difference on.
Okay. One other point before I let you go, because I think our listeners, after hearing that news conference, want something else entirely if they can. When it comes to questions on how we are living day-to-day life, we have heard some people ask about the handling of mail. And I'm curious to know what you can add to that.
So this is an interesting sort of dilemma. It's a small sort of encapsulation of a bigger picture issue, which is how much do we want to interrupt our daily life and the way that we generally go through existence for the goal of limiting the spread of disease? And so you could, in theory, stay inside all of the time, never go outside, never have contact with other people, and that would basically seal you off from pathogens. That would decrease hugely the chance of spreading any disease. However, we're social creatures and we go outside and we interact with other people and we have jobs and an economy that relies on us being in contact with other people. And so you can, to an extent, cut yourself off or limit interactions with the outside world. But, you know, it might not be the best cost-benefit analysis. And so the best information that we have right now coming from public health departments locally, in other jurisdictions, and public health officials nationally is that mail is not generally considered to be a strong disease vector for the coronavirus that causes COVID-19. Is it possible? Yes. Do we know that the virus can live on surfaces for, you know, hours? Yes. Is that the way that the vast majority of people, or even a small minority of people, are coming up with COVID-19? The best information that we have now says no. And so, you know, I am no health professional, but the information that I'm getting from people who are is, in theory, yes, the virus can live on surfaces for an extended amount of time. In practice, no, that is not how they are seeing the disease be transmitted. That's why they're advocating for social distancing, for keeping people from being less than 6 feet away from each other, for not going to work, because those are the disease vectors. Those are the ways that people are getting infected. In general, handling a package that's been delivered is not a way that people are getting infected.
Last thing, was it 8 days ago or 15 days ago we had the first? It was 8 days ago. First confirmed case in Rochester.
It's been a rapid rise. Yeah. I mean, and there is a lot that has changed in just a week.
I mean, it feels like it's been a year, so I'm just trying to get my head around how much has happened.
Somehow they've managed to jam a lot of days into just a small number of days. There's a lot of developments happening all the time. Earlier this week, Evan, I was in here and we were playing the sound from our county health commissioner, our public health commissioner, Dr. Michael Mendoza, a few days before then, saying that it was not time to shut down gyms, that people could continue to go out to exercise, that it wasn't time to shut down restaurants. Right. Only a few days after that, when cases started sort of marching upwards, both here and in nearby areas, we started shutting those things down. And now, just a few days after that, the governor comes out with this executive order taking effect Sunday that says that 100% of non-essential employees should not be showing up to work.
All right, I lied. There's one more thing.
Yeah.
I read a piece last night that actually gave me some hope. And what I mean by hope is this. We're all going to do our best, and we're doing our part here. And we are trying to envision, without a vaccine, how can we get to a point where we can come out of isolation? Can we come out of isolation pre-vaccine? And the answer is yes. Maybe in waves, maybe for a time, and then if we see flare-ups come back, you know, sort of reignite the social distancing.
There are a lot of people trying to model what this might look like.
Right.
Yep.
Right. But what gives me hope is if we can get widespread testing the way they do in Korea, we can do so much more to feel like we're playing offense instead of defense, as some of the best writers have said. The problem is, let's say we had a situation where everybody could get tested today, not even just people with symptoms. I mean everybody, so we could know where this thing is and who has it. That would be amazing, because then we could play the offense, and then we could start to think about opening businesses again, and we could do all this stuff. Where are the tests? What is happening? Is there any indication to you that anything's changing?
That's one of the things that I'm looking into.
The rest of the world is getting testing.
Both today and into next week, we're trying to figure out here where the bottleneck is. And the people that I've talked to locally, the people who run the tests, The people who submit samples for testing have said there are bottlenecks at basically every part of the system right now, from the swabs that you use to collect samples from inside people's noses. Many of those are manufactured in Italy. Italy's been hit hard by the coronavirus. Swab production is down, and that means that we are not able to get very many swabs locally. Then you have to put the swab into a little test vial. Those are in short supply. Once you get the test vial into the testing site, the laboratory, you need to use a reagent to separate the virus DNA from all the other substance that you collected inside the person's nose. That's in short supply.
Well, the White House says this stuff's coming. Where is it?
We haven't seen it yet, and I'm trying to figure out where it is.
That's I'm not blaming you. I don't mean to be yelling at you here, but
no,
you know,
that's
everybody
what the reporting
wants,
is.
Everybody wants, once this pipeline somehow gets unclogged, and it's been months now, when that happens, we can really start the process.
You're talking about offense versus defense. The offense that the public health department and that hospital officials are encouraging us to play right now is staying inside.
Right, but that's essentially defense. When I say offense is if we test broadly, then we can go out and say, you know what, despite not having a vaccine, we've got a good handle on testing, we have a good handle on cases, and we can get reopened in some measure.
One other little bit of good news is that the timeline for getting I don't know if as widespread as the ideal is, but more widespread testing to be able to test people, at least everyone who has symptoms, that is a shorter timeline we're expecting than the timeline for the vaccine. And so we might be able to get those tests in here sooner. It's a matter of months, probably.
Yeah. I mean, Korea did it in about 6 weeks. I mean, just an amazing, amazing difference. We had our first case on the same day that Korea had its first case. They are open for business. Amazing watching these daily briefings because I just can't believe that we're sitting here so slow, but we are. And it is not the fault of our local doctors, and it is not the fault of our local leaders.
No, I mean, as
everybody
as we,
wants these tests.
As we sit here, you know, bemoaning the lack of tests, there are people working to get those tests here. It's
yes.
not for a lack of effort.
Yeah.
I also just, at the end of this week, want to say a big thanks on the radio to the whole crew of people here. Who have been working on stories. We have done so much coverage, and I don't want to brag too much for us. There is a lot that we know we have not covered yet, but boy, I mean, I'm our health reporter, and I'm trying to stay on this all the time, but there are people who are not health reporters who are putting out stories about the impact of staying at home in situations of domestic violence. There are people who are reporting on the impact on local businesses, on children, on people's ability to access food, on educational issues. I mean, we are doing a lot, and I really appreciate, as our health reporter, all the other reporters that we have in this community who are working on this also.
Well said. Thank you, Brett.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for the work that you're doing. Brett Dahlberg, WXXI health reporter. And on that note, WXXI is like a lot of organizations across the country that are simply just going to be dealing with different financial realities. And it's going to be hard. We rely on public support. We rely on some underwriting. As you often hear, we have lost a lot of the underwriting. We understand that. We can't blame the partners who underwrite with us. But listeners, you're going to occasionally hear me say this, but I'm going to say it now. If you want us to be here in the same robust fashion, covering this community, supporting NPR National and International, and being here in Rochester in the strength that we are going to need you. Please, especially if you're still working, if you haven't lost income, please consider going to WXXINews.org/give. The give button is easy to find, and in about 2 minutes, you can make a contribution to public radio and journalism. During a crisis, you can make sure we are here. Let's bring in Linda Sue Park, whose remarkable book is Prairie Lotus. That's the newest of her many books. I just found out this morning that one of my favorite people from Rochester, Sean Dobbin, is related to Linda Sue Park. This is a very exciting day for me, having you. I mean, what an amazing family you have, Linda Sue. Did you always know that Sean was your son? I didn't know that.
I've known, I think, since he was born.
Wow. Well, what a remarkable family. And so let me remind the audience why you're here. You're here because your book is Prairie Lotus, which has been decades in the making. And you grew up, you know, sort of thinking about Laura and thinking about the Little House series. But that lens was different, as I mentioned at the outset. And for listeners who are just popping in here, why don't you give me a little bit of the broader frame of what you remember as a kid thinking about that series?
Sure. I just want to back up a tiny bit and say thank you to you yourself and to all the journalists who are doing this incredible work during such surreal times, to present information calmly and factually. It's really important most of us.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, so Prairie Lotus. I, like many readers, I loved the Laura Ingalls Wilder Little House books when I was a child. I read them over and over, and there were parts that made me uncomfortable. And as you said earlier in the intro, I would, on rereading, hold those pages together when I was reading so I could skip them. And the thing is that there has been a lot of discussion in the children's literature world about how the Little House books have and haven't aged well, right? And I was sort of wrestling with this because they weren't just my favorite books when I was a kid. They were a huge reason that I became a writer. So, you know, lying there in bed night after night after night, imagining that Laura was my best friend, imagining adventures that we would have together. As I grew older, imagining the romances that I would have had, you know, as her good friend, mm-hmm. You know, with the boys that she described in the town and so forth. That was like the equivalent of today's fan fiction, right? And they were among my first experiences at creating stories. So when people began to re-examine these books, and some people had less difficulty than others at saying, okay, these are no longer part of my canon. You know, whether it's a teacher saying I'm not going to teach them, mm-hmm. a parent saying I'm not going to read them to my kids, there were people who seemed to be easily, or maybe not so easily, but readily able to excise these books from their reading experience. And that wasn't me, just because they were just so entirely tangled up with my identity as a reader and a writer. And so there was a perfect storm of circumstances that started happening maybe 7 or 8 years ago that finally culminated in me saying, okay, what I actually want to do is write a book in which I have a conversation with Laura Ingalls Wilder, who passed away long ago, so I can't actually talk to her. And that's what Prairie Lotus became, is my saying to her, I loved your books, and I'm going to keep the good parts, but there were parts that really hurt me, and those I'm going to work on since you're not here to do that.
Are you angry with her for that?
No, I'm not. I know that some people are. I'm angry with the system that enabled her to write those books and so blithely dismiss genocide in those books. There was a system that allowed her to do that, and then to have the books be vaunted despite her completely, you know, ignoring the fact that what her family did was made possible by the removal and genocide of millions of people.
Hmm. Well, before we really get into what this book is about, because it's really beautiful. I don't want to sort of genuflect, but my gosh, what an amazing writer you are!
Oh, you can genuflect.
Sure, let's do it. Let's do it. I said to a colleague this morning. I said, Linda Sue Park is the Danielle Ponder of Rochester writers, which is like this category of people who you go, oh my gosh, I can't believe we know them and that we can sort of claim them locally because they should be internationally known in every household. I just find your writing to be so outstanding. And I said to a colleague this morning, Linda Sue Park is the kind of writer who doesn't have to prove it to you with a glitzy paragraph or a turn of phrase that looks like you were showing off. It's just so tight. It's like the words have always been on that page. It's like you picked up the pages and the words existed naturally as opposed to really straining to impress somebody with a scene or a point or a moment or a phrase. And I just, I have such appreciation for that. So that's it. Now we can move on. Is that okay?
Well, I'm the one who wants to genuflect now because that's the response that I always want from the reader. I always try to say that I'm trying to make myself invisible, that the story is more important than I am. You know, so that's my goal.
Well,
so thank you.
And let's talk a little bit about how to do that, especially when you are you know, writing during a time when there's a lot of focus on identity and who gets to tell what stories. So right now, we are in this sort of weird moment where the president is crossing off notes on his script and renaming the virus the Chinese virus. And I'm curious to know, first of all, I mean, your background is Korean, but I'm curious to know, as an Asian American, what you make of that.
Oh, well, I've had lots of experiences already. When things were, as you pointed out, things have moved so quickly. But at the end of February, I set out on what was supposed to be a 2.5-week book tour that was truncated after 10 days because of coronavirus, and we decided that, my publisher and I decided that I should come home. But on several of my flights, I had people standing very far away from me at the airport gate. You know, I felt I couldn't even clear my throat lest I spark a panic because all the news then was that it was, you know, China and Asian people, even though, you know, again, the facts that places like Singapore and South Korea, which I can tell you are full of Asian people, have actually done a way better job of containing this virus than we have. So I was very appreciative of how you brought that up, even in the context of this book, because one of the things that that books, especially for books for young readers, but all kinds of popular culture and media have to do, is to introduce and promote and represent all kinds of people, because that's how you undo stereotypes and fear based on misinformation, right? And quantity does count. You know, you can't just have a book or two from people of color. You have to have lots and lots and lots of them everywhere, and, you know, everywhere you turn. And, of course, they're important as what we call mirrors, so that those young people of color and other marginalizations can see themselves and can see that they're important enough for literature. But in times like this, it's even more important that the dominant culture see those images and read those books and experience those other lives through various forms of media, because that familiarization is the first step in the process of undoing fear and fear-based hate.
I had a brief back and forth with your son, Sean, about what's going on nationally right now, because, and I really want to sort of listen and take in a lot of experiences on this, because my view on what's happening is this. As I've said so often in the last couple of weeks, we're in a crisis, and Americans are desperate for leadership, and it does not have to come from whatever political party they're registered to. I mean, we have seen leadership from Democrats and Republicans in different states at state levels. We have seen disappointment from Democrats and Republicans at different levels in different places. But clearly, we are in trouble on the national level when it comes to the slow-moving federal response, and that's not debatable. That's not a partisan shot. I wish it weren't true, and I'm rooting every day for that to change. My concern is this. The president is very, very effective at getting people to sort of obsess over our cultural or identity differences. And George Carlin spent many years talking about how people at the top are pretty good at that. They get us to focus on our differences, and we fight amongst each other, and we don't pay attention to what's happening at the top. My concern is what's happening at the federal level. I want to understand the failures, focus on the failures so we fix them, and that we deal with this as fast as we can so fewer people die. That's my concern. My feeling is that the president continues to call this the Chinese virus because he wants us to obsess over that. He wants to take attention away from the failures because it's a political winner for him. And I would like us not to focus on that, but I'm also not an Asian American. And I know that there are costs to every decision we make in terms of how we react to this. What's your view on this, Linda Hsu?
I think I agree with everything that you've said and about the failure of leadership at the federal level. In some ways, this is probably not the greatest thing to admit, but I do sort of do the ostrich with my head in the sand thing. One example, I did not watch the press conference that preceded our hour.
Yeah,
I just thought I can't. So and the work that I do it's a long game. You know, when you write for young people, you're trying to equip them with the tools to solve the problems that they're going to confront when they get older, and to have them better equipped, hopefully, than today's adults were. Because look what happens when you when you have people, and I don't just mean the current administration, but I mean people who put him into office and people who support him, you know, who and many others who did not have the exposure in the form of, you know, books and thought-provoking other kinds of media when they were young. So, you know, it's sort of like, you know, as an Asian American, I'm just, you know, appreciative of people who are doing things like sharing lists of Asian American authored books, which is happening a lot in the Kidlit community on Twitter.
Yep.
And broadcasters like yourself who are saying, you know, look, the Spanish flu started in France. You know, I mean, that these labels are not at all helpful. You know, if you call it the Chinese virus and you take 5 steps away from me and 5 steps closer to the white person in the store, you're going to get it from them. Okay. You know, I mean, it's misinformation that is actually harmful, you know, that as you said, will lead to more deaths. That's a pretty sobering thing. And the information that we need is the sensible stuff that will hopefully keep more people alive. So that's the short game, and the long game is a book like Prairie Lotus to say, you know, let's look at history and the things that have happened through more than one lens, from more than one perspective, and have more information with which to make our choices and decisions.
Well, let's dive into the book. After our only break of the hour, Prairie Lotus is the book, the new book from author Linda Sue Park, who is our guest for the hour. The award-winning author and prolific writer is out with this book now. After decades of thought and, frankly, inspiration, but also concern about the Little House series, admiration for the big themes, but the concerns about representation and some of the historical writing. So this book is our focus after our only break of the hour here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections. With millions of Americans now staying home for extended amounts of time, the situation can become tense, and for some it can become dangerous. Domestic violence is on the increase. We're hearing that from authorities, police, and we know historically that's what happens in situations like this. So how can we all handle this? Talk with you Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So the year is 1880. And we're introduced to Hannah, a 14-year-old, and I'd like Linda Sue Park, our guest and the author of Prairie Lotus, to tell us first of all about Hannah and her dad and what we know at the outset of this book, their journey. Go ahead, Linda Sue.
Okay, so Hannah is 14 years old, and she and her father have left Los Angeles. They're essentially escaping grief. In 1871, there was a massacre of Chinese Americans in Los Angeles, a lynching of multiple Chinese immigrant men. And also, the Chinatown in Los Angeles was burned. And it's, of course, one of those historical incidents that, because it concerned people of color, it doesn't get taught in our schools. It's not part of our national consciousness. But Hannah's Chinese mother, because she's half Asian and half white, her Chinese mother had her lung smoke damaged by the fire and eventually, a few years later, died from that ailment. So Hannah and her father are trying to find a place away from those memories, and they actually travel east from the Los Angeles area and eventually decide to settle in Dakota Territory in 1880 in a fictional town called La Forge, which is based on Laura Ingalls Wilder's De Smet, South Dakota, where she lived for the last 4 books of the Little House series. And, of course, even that choice was deliberate. Laura's family traveled from the east, and so I'm setting up a family who is coming to Dakota Territory from the west of the United States.
Hannah's father is a white man, and her mother was Chinese, and that creates a complicated life for herself, and her dad knows that. What is the dynamic for this family of two this dad and his daughter, who frankly kind of wants to be a contributing person. She wants to make dresses. She wants to have these opportunities. But what's the dynamic that you wanted to create between the two of them, the complex dynamic of a father who had lost his wife, who might be worried about his child, who sees his child wanting to do more and become more of a woman? What's the dynamic you wanted there, Linda Sue?
Well, I think that, as you point out, it's a normal father-daughter relationship in many ways, with the daughter, with the father worried about his daughter growing up, especially without a mother to help guide her. Nowadays, mixed-race marriages are pretty common. In fact, I'm going to wager that almost all of your listeners today either have a mixed-race marriage in their family or know of one, that they're quite familiar with. And it is both a strength and a challenge. I mean, any marriage is, right? In fact, someone pointed out to me that, any marriage is a mixed marriage in one sense. But mixed race marriages have an additional layer or 5 or 10 of challenges and complications to deal with. So historical fiction, and you and I have talked about this before on earlier programs, setting a story in a historical era is a lens or a tool to examine the things that concern us today. So the example I use with kids is that Hamilton is not really about the Founding Fathers. It's about Mr. Miranda's concerns today, like rap music and people of color and, telling stories from different angles. And he just happens to use the Founding Father era to explore those concerns. So the relationship between races is certainly something that interests me today. And so I used Hannah's parents' marriage to explore that. And the fact that that even the most sympathetic and empathetic of people in a dominant culture can only understand so far what a person of color or other marginalized identity actually experiences.
Hmm. I want to read a little bit from a passage from the book as we talk about what it must have been like for kids like Hannah, thinking about what her future might allow and might not allow. And in this passage, she's thinking about Sam. And I'm going to go ahead and read, if you don't mind, here, and then we'll talk about
that.
She could hear the smile in his voice. As she hurried home, she tried to recall every word of the meeting, but she soon found herself thinking about Sam instead. She couldn't help smiling, and her cheeks flushed again. But the thrill was only momentary. Although she and Papa had never spoken of it, she had gradually come to realize what leaving California had meant for her future. In the Chinatowns of Los Angeles and San Francisco, there were so many men and so few women that she might have been able to marry a Chinese man, despite being half white. But the farther east they went, the fewer Asians they had seen. And here in the eastern half of Dakota Territory, there didn't seem to be any at all. Besides which, every territory that had become a state in recent years had made it illegal for whites and non-whites to marry. So Hannah was quietly making plans for a future that would see her dependent on no one except herself. Graduation, then a shop as a seamstress, first with Papa, and someday on her own. That's a heavy thing for a kid becoming an adult to be thinking about.
I think so, and I think especially for the times when the future for most women almost always revolved around marriage, and it took a person of great character and strength to say, no, that is not going to be my future, right? Obviously, there were women who faced that kind of future either out of choice, but more often out of necessity. But it's representative of the different kinds of confrontations that people of color have today, most of their lives. Growing up in a very small town in Illinois, we were the only Korean family in town until I was about 8. I have a very clear memory of the second Korean family moving to town when I was 9. And I knew, even at that very, very young age, I knew I would never be one of the quote-unquote popular girls. It didn't matter what my personality was or, you know, anything like that. That was just not an option for me, the way Hannah is thinking. You know, out here in Dakota Territory, marriage is not going to be an option for me. And I think that kids sense this at a very young age, and it's one of the reasons, once again, that I want so many books and movies and other, you know, other bits of popular culture and media to take away those limitations, to offer so that all kids feel like their possibilities are limitless.
Well, in a separate interview, you did say that, yes, things have changed, that a lot has changed since 1880, since Hannah's story that you're writing in Prairie Lotus. That doesn't mean that we're where we want to be, but I'm curious to know how much has changed from your own childhood. So let's take that moment that you can remember being a young girl thinking, well, I'm never going to be one of the popular kids. I will not be in the cool kid crowd because of who I am. And I think that has changed quite a bit from your childhood, but I mean, I'm curious to know if you agree.
I think it's very regional.
Okay, yeah, yeah. That's fair. It's right. Changed a lot in certain places.
That's correct. That's correct. And you know, other things that happen is, like, you know, we so many of us authors were misfits or nerds or whatever the word you want to call it is, and you know, we kind of write our books to spend our lives saying to kids like us, you know, if your high point is fifth grade or junior high or even sophomore year in high school, if that's when you're the cool kid and no other time in your life, that's not what you want. and you will get to the point where you don't really care anymore about whether or not you're a cool kid. And that's actually when you might become kind of cool.
That's
so that's a really that's hard to communicate to, you know, to kids who don't see that far into the future. But that's sort of what, you know, what we're trying to do. But yes, I think in certain parts of the country, things, you know, have changed. And, you know, it felt like with the last administration that there were real giant strides being made along those lines, and now we're taking many steps back. But I think that's always part of the process. That every generation has its responsibility to work on that arc of the moral universe, I think Dr. King called it, where we're trying to bend it toward justice all the time. And mm-hmm. And sometimes, especially these days, it can feel like it's kind of straightening out again. but you know, the alternative is to give up, right? And that's not an alternative. So you keep hammering away at it and find people who will work alongside you.
Well, I'm not sure I fully agree that, well, I mean, not that you're giving us only two alternatives, but certainly giving up is not appropriate. But I think the question a lot of people have in this moment is, what's the right way to fight for that progress back? Because it feels like those who have tried to roll back the progress revel in the fight and can use it to their advantage, when those who are calling for, you know, just rolling back bigotry, basic respect, understanding different cultures, it feels like, well, we should just shout that from the rooftops and that should be obvious. And it doesn't feel like it's working. What do you do with that?
Yeah, I do know what you mean about it, and it's emblematic of a greater problem, which is that it's much easier to deal in black and white than it is to deal in subtlety and nuance. And so, you know, the one side is trying to account for all kinds of nuances and differences, and the fact that we can't just, you know, paint everything with one brush, where the other side has perhaps more clarity despite having more blindness, mm-hmm. Which seems ironic. But in absolute, you know, sort of cruel, cold terms, I do see it as kind of a lashing out of a beast that knows its days are numbered. Already, the cohort who was 3 years old in 2015, okay, so today they're five years old. They were our first majority non-white demographic, right?
Mm-hmm.
So things are changing in this country, and we are moving towards becoming a majority non-white country. And that frightens a lot of people. And once again, people who are afraid often shut down and unhealthy emotions grow out of that fear. So I think it's just, it's a matter of, you know, having to, unfortunately, having to demonstrate our humanity, the humanity of all people, especially marginalized communities, to demonstrate our humanity over and over and over again, to say, you know, you really don't have anything to be afraid of. You might not be in the majority in future years, but that doesn't mean that things are going to go to Hades in a handbasket.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, for example, with Hannah in Prairie Lotus, I hope that there are parts of her story that any young reader can relate to. And, oh, yeah, she's half Asian as well. And so there will be different degrees of importance depending on the reader to that identity element. For some people, it will be very important, either because they see themselves or they want to show their children, whereas for other people, it'll be, oh, no, this is, hopefully, this is just a great story.
I think that's exactly at the core of what most people will end up with. And they'll probably wonder, well, Laura Ingalls Wilder did what, 7, 9 books? Are you going to do 7 or 9 on this series?
I would never say never. You know, this book took so long and was
But
really
you did it now. It's out
yes,
now.
It's true. But it was so emotionally draining. I'm not sure I'm ready to face another one yet. But I would never say never, as I just said.
My guest is Linda Sue Park, the Newbery medalist, the award-winning author. Her new book is Prairie Lotus. Can get it digitally now? Where can people get it now, especially in these sort of precarious times?
Well, I love to recommend a new organization called bookshop.org, which supports small independent bookstores, which is wonderful. And, of course, you can always order it online from the larger organizations, the larger websites. And it is available in both print and ebook form.
So before we close, I want to talk about some of the way that you write Hannah's interactions with Native Americans in this book. There are a number of occasions, and the first is pretty early in the book where her father is out hunting, and all of a sudden she realizes that, well, their wagon is kind of surrounded, and she's, you know, thinking, oh, I've seen them from afar, but here they are. And so she, 14-year-old Hannah, goes out, can't speak their language, but has a really interesting and what becomes a pleasant interaction where she makes a soup for them. She serves them soup, the Indian women's soup, and they end up leaving a gift for her that she's trying to figure out what it is. If I'm remembering, I think her dad said it was a prairie turnip or something. So they leave her a gift. So they have this interaction where they can't speak each other's language, but it's quite beautiful. And it doesn't, even from those early pages, it doesn't feel... I'm going to be clumsy when I try to describe what I'm thinking here, Linda Sue. It doesn't feel forced. It feels sort of thoughtful, natural, careful. And as an author, I'm curious how you went about that process of making sure those scenes are handled with care.
Well, I very much wanted to address the question of the treatment of Native Americans in this story, because that's the most problematic in the Wilder books. There's also a scene of blackface in Little Town on the Prairie, which, you know, is very offensive to African Americans. But I decided I was going to have to leave that one aside because I was already having a lot on my plate dealing with the Asian side of things. But the Native American part is something I really wanted to explore in this story. And that scene that you're talking about, one of the things that was important to me is I include a very few lines of actual Dakota language, which are not translated or italicized. The reader doesn't know what the women are saying, and neither does Hannah, right? So the reader's experiencing that sort of mystified, what are they saying, right alongside Hannah. But that was really important to me because if you think about the traditional or the classic portrayal of Native Americans in Hollywood and in children's books, they speak Pidgin English or they grunt, you know. And nobody points out, well, actually, they speak a lot better English than the white people do any native language. You know, no one ever points that out. And I wanted young people to see that, just a glimpse that native nations here in this country had very vibrant cultures, including, of course, fully developed languages, which we just don't often get a chance to see. And so that's just one example of how I wanted to counter the narrative in the Little House books and in popular culture generally, of the way natives have been presented in these ways. And I wanted my native characters to be fully developed, to feel very real. Of course, only one of them is named, an older woman named Wishapi Win, and to build her fictionally. She has an entire backstory. You know, I have little notes jotted down about, you know, starting when she was about 8 years old and what her childhood was like and you know, how she grew up, and she's had six children and so forth and so on. So in order to, I think this is true for many authors, but anytime you want to create a character, we do spend a lot of time on our main characters and our major secondary characters. But for any important character, even Wishapi Win, who only, you know, who has relatively less time on the page than any of the other named characters in the book, I created a whole backstory for her so that she was very real to me as I was writing her.
So, as we get ready to wrap the program here, Linda Sue Park, our guest, the author of Prairie Lotus, the book that's out now. When it comes to the issue of representation, you know, your readers are probably going to feel like I did. They're not going to know if a name like Wishapewin or some of the language that they see spoken. Frankly, even for me, some of the description of Hannah's mother's, what led to her death eventually, the Chinatown riots, I think, in the 1870s, in which I think, if I remember, you said that there were 10 or 15 Chinese men who were lynched?
Yes, 21.
Oh, 21.
Yeah.
Those are, as much as we know, these are drawn from real events and faithfully drawn, or are they?
Yes. Okay. That massacre is a historical event.
I figured it was, just because of the way you wrote it and given your sort of sensitivity to this. When it comes to Wishapewin, when it comes to the native interactions, how much of the actual language we're encountering on the page is faithful language, and how did you address that?
I can't say that it's faithful to 1880. It's actually Dakota language today.
Okay.
Right? Yep. So, and that was provided to me by a native Dakota speaker. So,
sure. And so I guess where I'm going is this. There's been a lot of talk about American dirt and who writes what stories. What's your view on how thoroughly we should vet who is writing which stories?
Okay. So I think that it's another question that will become easier with time because of sheer numbers. Okay, if you have a look, there are through the history of, for example, the Newbery Medal, there are several books with Asian topics, and most of them were written by white people. Okay, so that they have not aged well. Let's just put it that way. So back then, if you wanted a book on an Asian topic, it was almost always was written by a white person, right? Because people from Asian backgrounds and other marginalized backgrounds were simply not getting published. That is slowly changing. It's not changing fast enough, but it definitely is changing. So that in the case of a book like American Dirt or any other book where the author does not share the main character's identity elements, you are getting more and more choices where for example, immigration stories like that, there are books written by Latinx writers. And so if you have a choice, seek those out. I mean, that's what I would say. And it will get easier and easier to do that as more and more of them are published. Okay? I mean, you can make all kinds of analogies to other things in life. You know, if you are wanting to read a book about any subject, just say one of my loves, baseball. You know, I want a book written by someone who is an expert on baseball. And the longer their expertise extends, the better, mm-hmm. right? I don't want somebody who just researched baseball even for 5 years, right? I want to read a baseball book by a baseball expert. And I think that there is a parallel there to lived experiences. Okay, if I'm going to read a Latinx immigrant book, I'm going to choose something like Ephraim Divided, which is by Ernesto Cisneros. I'm going to choose something like The Land of the Cranes by Aida Salazar, wonderful books by an adult author, Urrea, U-R-R-E-A. So there are choices, right? And that's where I would go first before going to something
gotcha.
Like American Dirt.
Congratulations on this book.
Thank you so much, and I so appreciate your having me on.
Linda Sue Park, and Beth, by the way, in Penfield says, Xander's Panda Party is my daughter's favorite book, and Linda Sue Park is awesome. Agree. Absolutely agree. Hey, real briefly, as we're closing up here, Linda Sue, I know there's a difference between YA, middle grade, children's, et cetera, different genres. What genre would you let the listeners know for those who have inquired? Prairie Lotus.
This is called upper middle grade. I would say ages 10 to 14.
Okay. Thank you so much, as always. And I look forward to when we can see each other in person again.
I will look forward to that, too. Thank you.
Linda Sue Park, our guest. Listeners, we know a lot of you are home right now. We want to know how it's going with you. How has this disruption affected your household? Tell us at WXXI how it's going. There's two ways. Send us a voice memo to newsroom@wxxi.org. A voice memo to newsroom@wxxi.org. Or call us. Leave a voicemail. Here's the number, 585-209-3180. 209-3180. We can air your stories. We are all in this together. And we'll be back with you on Monday. Megan Mack, producer, Rob Braden, engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have as good a weekend as you can. Thanks to MRA Stein, the intern, as well. We'll talk to you Monday.